This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2022, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders Educational Programs on March 24 and 25, 2022, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Well, good afternoon to each of you, and welcome to this session. This is basically a typical time of the day when people start to get drowsy and you start struggling to stay awake. And so I'm going to try to have a mix of stories as well as some of the boring stuff to kind of make it all work out. It's kind of a difficult subject in the whole world of dealing with Muslims to speak about. But I do want to preface this to say that this is informational. This is not how you go about reaching Muslims. It's about what you need to know in a background when you're working in a Muslim context to know what's happening around you. Because I walked into working in the Islamic culture completely unaware of all of that happening, because we have a general picture in our mind of what Muslims do, what Muslims believe, how they live, and then we discover that there's other things happening around us, and we don't even know about it. I was recently just back in Bangladesh again and working in the Rohingya camp there, which is a group of refugees who came out of Myanmar into Bangladesh. They are a minority Muslim group. And at the camp there, we have a clinic. And one component of the activities of the clinic is that we teach how to do agriculture as a way of helping to sort of sustain themselves, and also we try to fit it under the idea of nutritional help as well, because they're not given a real balanced diet in the camp, and our main purpose of it actually is a way to interact with people. That's why we have the clinic there. It's about interacting with people. It's a medium where you can continue to interact with the same group of people. So we have this nutritional thing that we're doing, and we were going around visiting different of the beneficiaries from the program, and I noticed something. There was a compost pit that they were teaching them how to compost all of the scraps and stuff from their houses, because the land is actually not cultivated land. They moved into what had been a forest and just cut the trees down, dug the dirt. So it's very infertile. So we were trying to teach them, instead of trying to give them fertilizer, let's make compost out of what you have. So they had this nice hole in the ground, and they had composted stuff in it, and then they had plants planted around the edge of this compost hole, and they were just beautiful. Just really beautiful vines growing up over the side of this hut that they lived in. And around it, they had like some bamboo strips kind of in an open cage, because animals run loose. And so you get everybody's chickens and whatever get into your plants. And so they had this little cage there, and there was this funny object hanging on the side of this piece of bamboo. And as soon as I saw it, something went off in my brain. So I asked the guys, hey, what's that jaw, cow jaw, hanging on that fence for? Oh, well, they kind of got a little sheepish. Well, this plant was just beautiful, lush, green, nice big flowers. They didn't want anybody to come along and comment on how beautiful that plant was, because the evil eye and the jealousy, that plant just might curl up and die tomorrow. So it was to detract from the nice-looking plant because of other things that might happen to your plant. Another thing that you'll see very common in the Islamic cultures, at least in the Asian, South Asian cultures, is that you'll see little children running around and they have a big dot on their forehead. And when I first saw it, I kind of assumed that the child had fallen down and bumped their head. And then I started noticing that, well, these children over here must fall frequently, because they all have these dots, like bump marks on their heads. They tend to be a little darker skinned anyway, and then there's this black smudge there. And so then one day I saw, well, here they were making it. They had a spoon, and they like put a drop of vegetable oil on it, and then they had a match underneath the spoon, and they heated this little bit of oil up till it starts to smoke up, and then they would take that burnt oil and make a smudge on their forehead. What are they putting smudges on the children's foreheads for? And so, you know, as the conversation goes on, and I got to inquiring about it, and to realize they don't want you to comment on their child being cute. Don't tell them their child is beautiful or cute. They do something to make it so that it's not. Because if you would say, oh, you have such a beautiful child, well, there's some jealous factor out here that could attack that child and it would die. Or it would become ill. And so we don't want to comment on how beautiful the child is. So if in their culture they do, they will say something like, mashallah, which basically means it's God's blessing to you. You wouldn't want to comment on something of anything of their contribution to a child being beautiful or healthy looking or anything of that because of an evil presence that could create jealousy among them and they would take the child. Now, the evil eye thing is pretty much, I think, universally thought about in the Muslim world. Although it does vary from culture to culture, country to country, on how prevalent maybe it is. If you go to a country like Turkey, you just see these little, like earring type of things or little doodads that you can hang on stuff, and they got a little blue eye on them. It's very, very prevalent in Turkey on that evil eye thing. You don't see as much of the eye itself in a place like Bangladesh or the sub-Asian countries, but it exists in their thought processes. But sometime or another after this child will get a little older, and maybe about the two-year age, I'm just going to guess, you don't see him put that on anymore. But you'll notice something else starts to show up, and it can even start even at a much younger age. But you'll see a little doodad thing about yay long, and it looks maybe like a 44 mag that somebody shot, and it's just like a little round gizmo about yay long, maybe about the size of your little finger. And they have it tied around their arm. It might be around their waist. It might be hanging around their neck. But that little thing is also to ward off evil that might be out there lurking around. You don't know. And what's interesting is what is inside that little thing. And I can talk about this a little later. It's actually a piece of the Quran most of the time inside that. But what's interesting, I think, about that whole thing is the Hindus wear the same thing. Now, why is it that a Hindu is wearing this little amulet and so is a Muslim? And so I tried to ask him, what's inside? What's the difference between yours and theirs? How come this one is holy and that one isn't? Are you wearing the same thing? And no, it's very different. It's not what the Hindus wear, but it's the same thing. And it's to ward off curses, evil, sicknesses, and etc. The first village that I lived in, actually in Bangladesh, we became good friends with a family that lived right at the edge of the property that where we stayed. Like you could have thrown a cricket ball, for those of you who know about cricket, maybe a baseball or something like that. You could throw a cricket ball and land it in their courtyard. And so we learned to know this family quite well, and the oldest daughter was about 17 years old, and it was high time to get her married, and so directly they got her married off to somebody else that she didn't know. But anyway, they moved to Dhaka City. He had a job in Dhaka City, which is the capital of Bangladesh. And so they lived there for some time, and no children. Now, in Islamic culture, children are very, very important. A man is entitled to have children. And if a wife doesn't have children, he'll marry a second time or a third time because that's his right as a father is to have children. And preferably a son, if you could have a son first. It doesn't have to be, but definitely you want children. And time was passing, and this girl was not having a child. And I knew there was distress in the family. And he started to talk about marrying a second wife. And I asked him, I was like, how are you going to marry a second one? You can't pay for the first one, because they were quite poor. Well, that doesn't seem to factor in. You just ditch the first one. They just become disowned. So this was stressful for her, because what happens for her when she gets ditched? So finally this went a year or two, and one day she called me up and she said, brother, I need you to give me some money. I need to go to the doctor because this is getting it's getting serious. His family was putting pressure on her, and I'm not sure what the girl's supposed to do about that. Like, his family is pressuring her. That's things that's controlled by God, you know? And so she wanted money to go to the village, back to her village, to see a doctor. And I got suspicious about it, and I said, well, listen, we're living in the capital here. You're right where all the best doctors in the country are. Let's go to one of them. I'll pay for your doctor's visit to whatever doctor here locally that you can find to go to see what the issue is. No, she needs to go back to the village. I said, well, you'll have to figure anyway, back to the village. I'm not paying for you to go back to the village. There's nothing down there. Well, it went a couple of weeks, and I got a phone call. Hey, she's back from the village. Oh, you're back from the village. Yeah, you got there somehow. Okay. She did. What did you do in the village? Oh, I went to see a doctor. Okay. So soon after that, I was there to see her. Yep. She had one of those amulets. She had went to a village doctor. A village doctor is actually an imam, a religious teacher in the village. And he has special powers that he can do. She gave him money. He produces this little amulet. She comes back wearing it. Pretty soon she was pregnant. She had a baby. Do you believe in it or don't you? When you're in poverty and you can't afford doctors and you can't afford these things, there's places that you turn to answer life's questions and to find results. I can still remember one of my first encounters with the whole occultic idea in the village. We had been there for almost a year, and we had volunteers coming. We were rebuilding houses after a cyclone, or we call it a hurricane in the U.S. So we were rebuilding, and about 300 and some volunteers had come through, and this is 2008, so not everybody had access to things like we do now. So we had a CAM laptop that we had email on. So people volunteers would come in the evening, they'd write emails home to their families and things like that. Now we have WhatsApp, we can do it a whole lot quicker and more efficiently, but they would write emails, and one night, the laptop disappeared. Well, the last guy who said he used it, he had been over beside the one window, and it had a grate over it, but clear up at the top, there was a broken bar out of it, and apparently that laptop went out through that window somehow. I don't know how they got that out there, but that was the only place. You can't fold a laptop. It had to fit out through that spot. How they got in there and got it, I don't know. We had a guard when we went there. That was one of the things they had determined, that there was going to be guards to watch these Americans. And so we had a guard sitting there all night long. How did the laptop get out the window? Well, my suspicion is that he had a younger brother, and he was an accomplice, and while he didn't take it and he didn't see it, he made sure no one else did either so that somebody else could get the laptop out. So we went around this thing, and I needed that laptop pretty bad because it had all our records on it. Everything was on that laptop. And so I started pressuring this boy who was the guard pretty hard about where this laptop got to. And he got a little frustrated, and he said, okay, we'll solve this problem. We'll go down to the imam, down to Abdul, and we'll give Abdul some money, and Abdul can look in the mirrors, and he'll tell us who stole it. And I said, well, we don't need to give anybody money. We don't need to look in mirrors. Just go tell your brother to bring the laptop back. But that suddenly raised me an awareness in my mind. The idea of looking in mirrors isn't associated with some little hut back in a dingy woods at the corner of society. This is the imam. That's where you go to look in the mirrors. The religious people, the man who's leading the prayers, is the man who's looking in the mirrors. So it is entrenched right into the complexity of their religious society. That's the person who gives you the amulet. That's the man who can look in the mirrors. So I got to thinking, well, maybe, surely, this doesn't represent Islam as a whole. Okay, so we're working in what's used to be British India. You know, they got their own sort of set of Islam down there. Now, something to be aware of, the majority of Muslims are not Arab. Somehow we associate Islam with the Middle East. They are actually a minority in the Muslim world. Indonesia has your largest population. Then I think it's Pakistan, India, Bangladesh. These are not Arab-speaking countries that hold a majority of the Islamic people. So I thought, well, maybe the true Islam out of Saudi Arabia would be different. So I started doing a little research, and I found an article that's printed in the Jerusalem Post that is entitled Black Magic Widespread in the Middle East. Belief in witchcraft, spells, the occult, and protective charms runs deep despite religious and government bans against using magic. When Tara Umar was a young bride in her first marriage, she and her Moroccan husband took the youngest sister of a family friend into their home. On the day the young Moroccan woman arrived, she gave Umar a doll, which Umar promptly placed in a dresser drawer. When Umar told a friend about the doll, the friend suspected it was an item for black magic and suggested the doll be destroyed. Instead, Umar tossed it into the garbage. That's when the household items disappeared. The family dog barked incessantly. Umar started fighting with her husband, and she began seeing strange insects in the house. When the guests finally moved out, the couple found their bedsheets and an identical doll to Umar's among the woman's discarded belongings. The message to Umar was clear. The woman she invited in her home sought to destroy her happiness through black magic. Umar is since remarried to a Saudi and now lives in Riyadh. She runs the popular blog Future Husbands and Wives of Saudis, a help website for non-Saudis marrying Saudis. As a quasi-marriage counselor for brides and grooms nervously entering Saudi society, Umar dispenses religious and practical advice to help ease the cultural shock. That includes providing insight into the real-world concerns of black magic in the evil eye. The truth is that all magic is haram or prohibited and only leads to bad ends. Belief in black magic runs deep in Saudi society. The issue was raised last month when the quasi-legislative body Shura Council granted permission for Moroccan women to work as maids in Saudi households. Hundreds of Saudi women complained to the council that granting Moroccan maids permission to work was tantamount to allowing the use of black magic in their homes to steal their husbands. Saudi wives complained the issue was not lacking trust in their husbands, that the men were powerless to ward off spells. When greeted with skepticism in Western societies, Saudis would no more question the existence of black magic than they would question Islam. So it's there. It is particularly common in Oman, Sudan, Yemen, Morocco, and Indonesia. Turkey is a secular Muslim country, but protection against the evil eye is deeply rooted in virtually all aspects of daily life. Tools of witchcraft, including using lizards, dead birds, photographs, hair, thread, dirt, blood, and red ink. Hiding places to place spells may be in bedrooms and under beds. Written spells generally contain the intended victim's name and one or two words to state the intent to do harm. The religious police in Saudi removed 23 black magic items from a particular place, including knives, written spells on paper from two graves in a cemetery. Black magic artists placed the tokens at the head and feet of corpses. Another lady that was interviewed told the media line that she had difficulty finding a job and failed in many interviews, and she hated the job she did find. She broke up with her fiancé, couldn't find a husband. My sister told me to read Surah Al-Baraka to protect me against any spell, she said. After 14 days, my father found a spell written on paper and in blood with my name on it on the roof under our water tank. Evidence. It exists. Anyway, so we look at all of that. And we said, wow, how did all of that end up in this religion that that we think of on a completely different front than that? And there are a few things that is helpful to understand about Islam itself. Where's the clock? What time is my? Okay. Christianity makes a very singular claim. It says that the more we open ourselves to worshiping God, the more that we follow the teachings of Jesus, the more we read the scriptures, the more we open ourselves to the working of the Spirit, the more we become like God Himself. We begin to have a relationship with God that actually draws us into Him, and we begin to take on the qualities of God. Now you think about that. If it's not true, then how do we become the hands and feet of Jesus? How does someone see that person is different? He met Jesus. You have seen, you and I have seen and have hopefully experienced the change of who you were to something different when we met Jesus, because we gave up things and become like him. That's a very unique concept in Christianity. And if you know of another religion that teaches that, I would be open to hearing about it because I'm not aware of it. Most people, including like a Hindu, you think about what they do. They worship, all right. They worship the idol, but the purpose of the worship is to satisfy or to prevent that god from breaking out onto them. They never hope to end up like that god. It's about a preventing something bad from happening to them from that god. That's very, very different than Christianity. We worship God to actually draw near to him and take on his qualities. For a Muslim, he doesn't experience God either. A Muslim does not know God. The Quran is actually a revelation from God, not of God, from God, telling you what you need to do to enter paradise. It is aside from who God is. So our scriptures is the Bible is about helping us understand God, revealing God to us. The Quran doesn't do that. The Quran only tells you how to get to paradise or prevent you from going to hell. It's not about who God is. They don't have a relationship to God. You don't know who God is. The only thing that they know about God is his 99 names. He has 99 names, and you'll see them sitting there with their beads. And there's 33 beads in the ring, and they're going through these beads. And they're saying the names of God, such as Ar-Rahman, the most merciful. Ar-Rahim, the bestower of mercy. Al-Malik, the king and owner of dominions. Al-Qudus, the absolutely pure. Al-Salam, the protection and giver of peace. Al-Aziz, the Almighty. Al-Amin, the All-Knowing, the Omnipotent. Al-Hasib, the Reckoner, the Sufficient. Al-Ahad, the Unique, the Only One. And they go on and on. And then most of them are also people's names. If you start to learn to know, there's Qudus and there's Al-Amins and there's whatever. But those names are to tell you qualities about God, but we don't know him. It's just something that's out there. Now, there is a whole interesting thing about the 100th name, because why would God only have 99 names when 100 is such a perfect number? So we'll get a little bit to that later, hopefully, if we don't run out of time here. So now imagine yourself in a position like that where we actually don't know if God hears my prayers. I don't even know if God knows who I am. God exists. We know that. And there's believed to be an angel, one on your right shoulder, one on your left. The one on your right's recording your good deeds. The one on the left recording your bad deeds. And you hope when you get to the end of time and you stand before Allah that your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds, but you're still not sure. So you're hung in that limbo. And now you actually face difficulties in life, and especially in the world of poverty, when you can't just pay money to go to the doctor. You can't, and things begin to go wrong. Suddenly, there's a whole open door to a different world called the occult. Because in that world, things happen. Things actually move in that world. This other one, we're told about, we're sure it's true, it's the best one, but it doesn't give me a connection to a power beyond myself. And so we open that all up. Well, how did that all end up happening, that suddenly they are even so much aware of that? Well, part of that comes from, I think, the very origins of Islam itself. Now, that should be shocking to most Muslims to consider it from that perspective. But when Muhammad grew up, he lived in an idolatrous society full of idols. The Kaaba that we hear about today, that they all go over and they circle how many times and all of that, That was actually a place that housed 365 idols. Now, when Muhammad finally became in a position as the leader of the Muslim world, they cleaned all those idols out. But he was raised in a very idolatrous society. So he's very aware of that and the activities that surround idolatry and the worship of idols. So have that in the back of your mind. And then we hear about how the Quran came into existence. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. It's very interesting. We don't get that from the Quran. We get it from something called the Ahadith. And there are volumes of Ahadith that are out there that are very debated about how valuable they are or what they contain. But there are collections, and there are six main collections that they adhere to. The most one that is the most considered most authentic is Al-Bukhari. And he has like 4,000 hadith, which are basically recordings passed down 250 years after the fact. Remember this. There is nothing that we know about from the time of Muhammad that's not, that we don't learn from the hadith. So 250 years after the life of Muhammad, Al-Bukhari writes down these things that he collected from people who passed it from one generation to another, the story of how the Quran came. And the story of the coming of the Quran is, and I can give you the references if you want to look this up, it's the same ones that they read, that Muhammad married a rich lady, and he began to have time for himself. And so he would go into a cave up on the mountain called Hira and fast and pray during certain times of the year. And once as he was there, praying and fasting for a number of days, he got met by a being. It's not actually clear in the hadith what the being was. Now, most translations, because you're not going to read it in Arabic, you're going to read it in English, if you read it. In the translation, it'll have little parentheses, and it'll say Angel Gabriel. Now, that's been added there. Okay, that's not in the writing. That has been somebody else. In fact, it went, I think, 10 or 15 years after this incident that Muhammad says for the first time that the angel, the name even Gabriel even comes up. But as he was in this cave fasting, this being came to him and said, recite in the name of Allah. Or basically means read or write. They use the word recite. And he said, I can't do that. I'm an unlearned person. I'm illiterate. And this being grabbed him and squeezed him until his breath was gone and released him and said, recite in the name of Allah. And he said, I can't. I'm not a learned person. I can't do that. This being squeezes him the second time. This happens three times. And finally, at the end of the third time, he says, just whatever Allah wills, just let that happen. And so this being gives him a message about how you're most loved of Allah, and that I created you from a clot of blood, which is so amazing. And goes there, and then he disappears. Muhammad leaves the scene and goes to his house shaking, scared. The muscles between his shoulder are in spasms. And he tells his wife, he's like, I met something in the cave, cover me up. So she covered him up until his fear left him or subsided to where he could speak. And he said, told her what happened. She said, oh, that wasn't a bad thing. You've just been met by a messenger of God. You're a prophet. And she convinced, it's very interesting that happens, because in Islam, the value of a woman's word is worth half of a man's. So a lady who did not see the being that attacked him convinced him, with half the value, that what he saw was an angel, and his opinion was he had met a demon. But that's the glorious start of the Quran. And that's how a Muslim is taught, this glorious coming of the Quran. A good friend of mine who was a Hujar, which is a very highly taught person in the thing, who is now a believer, when we first talked about this, he's like, you know, about this glorious coming of the Quran. I said, well, you know what? I'm not going to debate that. But I said, one thing you need to think about is that Gabriel has showed up on the scenes of time more than one time with messages. Okay? But if it's Gabriel, there's something interesting. Consistently, we see what happens when Gabriel shows up. He shows up, people are frightened because they're seeing an angel, and he calms. Peace. I have a message. That situation is calmed down. The message is given, and he departs, and something results. Never does Gabriel latch a hold of somebody and squeeze the breath out of them to convince them that this is a message from God. It's just inconsistent with what Gabriel does or how he historically worked. So I said, I questioned whether that was actually Gabriel. And the man said to him, he said, you know, I have been taught that ever since I can remember, the glorious coming of the Quran. But now that you mention it, sounds weird. It does. So what association of darkness is actually in the very beginnings of the Quran and how it comes to be or in existence? So that's one thing that I find very interesting in the is part of the very origin that the coming comes into. The next thing that's very interesting is that many of the rituals that Muslims do when they go on Hajj, which Hajj is when they make the travel back to Saudi Arabia, to Mecca, and they do their thing at the Kaaba. They go and they circle it so many times, and they're running back and forth between hills, and they're throwing stones at there's some big black stones that they throw rocks at to, has something to do with stoning the Satan and some things like that. And in fact, now the way I understand is they're actually renovating that, and they're making a three-tiered building so that you can get three deep throwing rocks because they have too many people. They actually limit how many people can go on Hajj because it's just not enough space. So they're making money off of this, mind you. They make a lot of money off of this. I've seen some very upset Bangladeshis because a lot of Bangladeshis work for the government. When they go to retire, they get a big payout. And they'll take that payout, and they'll go to Saudi Arabia and blow it. And the one man he was talking to, he was so angry. He's like, that country is destroying us, taking all our money out of our... And now dad goes and spends all his money going on Hajj. And once it's gone, then all us children have to take care of it because they suck the money out of it. But anyway, so it's a very commercialized thing. They got a three-tier thing where you can throw stones. What's interesting about all that is you can go into literature that predates Muhammad. And guess what? The tribes the tribes in the Arab Peninsula are gathering. There's a certain time of the year when they had agreement to not fight, and they would gather at this place of Mecca and circle the Kaaba. And they would run back and forth between hills. And they would throw rocks at black stones. Or stones at black rocks, or however you want to run that down. But suddenly, these activities have become associated with Abraham and Ishmael in the well and Hagar traveling between the hills looking for this for a source of water. And that's what they're commemorating when they go to Hajj. But the truth is those activities predate Islam and were associated with idol worship. So how does... Is black magic and all of that wind up in Islam? It's in its very core, actually. Whether they understand it or whether it's not, that's where those things came from. There's another thing that's very interesting in Islam. There's something that they call jinn. Jinn. What is jinn? Well, jinn are created beings. But you've never seen one. They're created beings, but instead of being made out of whatever we are made out of, they're made out of fire. And in fact, if you look at a fire, you sit by a campfire, and right when that flicker of flame goes up, right at the tip, right where it kind of goes that bluish, goes out nothing, right there is whatever that is what they were made out of. But you can't see them. But they exist. And if I understand right, there's a jinn born every time a person's born. So you have a jinn that is your twin that travels and exists around you. And I don't know of anybody else that knows anything about jinn other than Muslims. Now, you can go into almost any society, and they believe that there are good spirits and evil spirits. And we have angels and we have demons. So we don't argue about spiritual beings that exist that are good or bad. We agree that, but they have another group of something known as jinn. Incidentally, most of them are by nature bad. But there are, according to Muhammad, a group of the jinn who heard him reciting the Quran and were so overwhelmed that they became Muslims. So they became good. So there are actually a group of them out there. How he knows that, I don't know. It's somebody in that world contacted him in this world and said that's what happened to him. But we don't see them, but they coexist with us. And these jinn, they kind of, they tend to haunt dirty places or out-of-the-way places. They're like, they're on the fringes around you all the time. They're not like right in the middle of the room, but they're hanging over in a corner over there or over here in a corner. Or especially bathrooms. Bathrooms are notorious for jinn hanging out there. And so much so that there's actually a whole chapter in the Quran titled The Jinn. And it basically surrounds how do you deal with the jinn around you and how do you ward off their evil and things like that because of their influence and impact in the world in which we live. And so there's certain verses that you want to read, certain chapters that you say at certain times that ward off jinn and ward off their effect. And it goes out into their daily life. So suddenly you have a good side to you and a bad side to you. You have a clean side and a dirty side to you. Your left side is dirty. Your right side is clean. You never eat with your left hand. You don't do that. Now, problem is, in Bangladesh, they eat with their hands. Which is, I like that. God gave that to you first before he gave you a spoon. But if you're left-handed, you're in a little bit of a quandary. Don't go there and eat left-handed. There's issues with that. Well, what all goes into that? So they try to tell you, well, you know, you don't have toilet paper, so left hand, you know what you do with that one. You keep your right hand clean. It's more than that. It's about which side of the bed you get out of. It's about which foot you put out of the bed first. It's about which foot you put into the door when you go into the toilet. You want to go in with your right foot, and then when you come back out, you want to exit with a certain particular foot, and then there's words that you say when you're going in, and there's words you say when you're going out, and all these things to ward off jinn that might be hanging out in there or any of a number of other things. So their life, they have things that they're supposed to say in all kinds of stuff. You'll see them stop before they get in a car and they'll say something. Then they'll jump in the car. Well, if you go back and look, it's the same words that Muhammad said before he climbed on his camel. Okay, they don't ride camels, ride cars, but you know, you figure out how to make it work into your life situation. Certain things you got to say to ward off or to prevent evil or something bad happening to you. One of the things that was of huge concern to the neighbor girls there was that any of our girls that went out after night, that they were supposed to have their heads completely covered. Your veil does not work. It's supposed to be covered completely. Well, what's up with that? Well, these jinn will jump into your head. The ghosts and stuff will jump into your head if you go out at night without having your head covered. So these things are sneaky, and you got to be very, very careful with all of that. And so you have that whole world in there, and then you have to combat that whole world because that's the world that you live in. And so you get into how to take care of those things. And one of the most powerful things to control that is the Quran itself. Because you see, the Quran itself is magical. Just take and think about this. The Quran is about the same size as our New Testament. Millions of people have memorized the entire thing, word for word, in Arabic, and they don't even speak that language. I haven't met a Christian yet that's already memorized the whole chapter, let alone the whole New Testament. How can they do it? It's miraculous. That's how it happens. It's miraculous. The Quran itself is just There's just power in it. That's how you can remember it, even if it's in another language and you don't even know. I've met people in Bangladesh who memorize the entire Quran in Arabic and don't know what one word of it means other than Allahu Akbar or something. How can you even? I can't remember English sentences, let alone words that I don't even know. But they do it. Evidence, just one evidence, and they're just. I could go into a whole big long detail of how the Quran is. That's not serious. I thought I had to 3:30. Okay, well, things that you do that, how do you use the Quran in a magical way? You got a problem coming up, you got an exam coming at school, you have an illness in your family, they'll take a chalkboard and they'll take and write the verse in Arabic with chalk. Then you take and you wash it off into a cup and you drink it. You've just ingested the magic. You just took it right in. It's now part of you. Or you take and you write it on pieces of paper and you wrap it up in these little amulets and you stick it inside this little thing and you carry it with you. That's how you ward off evil. Then there's another thing that I really wanted to get to. And that is there's something that's called Sufism that is very, very prevalent in the Southeast Asian countries. And I'm talking Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, down into Myanmar. It's something called Sufism. And Sufism is actually started out as a result of because people found the deadness of Islam to be torture. They wanted to have a connection with Allah. And so the Sufi thing is about a connection with Allah. And the people who lead those groups are called peers. And a peer is a religious man of some nature. And he has certain knowledge, special knowledge that he has, and it gets passed on from one peer to another peer. So it's not openly known knowledge. And when I was just over the last time, I was talking to a man who was a convert. He had been an imam. And we got to talking about this thing. I was like, what exactly is this peer? And he told me something that I was not aware of. And it's very interesting because I started to research it a little bit. And I found that what he was telling me is right. And what it has to do with is the 100th name of Allah. So Allah is known by 99 names. The 100th name the peer has access to. That's what makes him special. Because he has a knowledge that the rest of you don't have. And this is what that is. The 100th name of Allah is Anna. The learned scholar and mystic Ansar al-Halaj was put to death in the 9th century for revealing this secret. Many at the time did not understand the true meaning behind his words. Anna, I haq, I am the truth. And those that did could see it's potentially dangerous to their prestige and authority. That's why he was silenced. Al-Halaj said, I saw my Lord with the eye of the heart. I asked, who are you? He replied, you. It takes only a wise person to understand what was meant by this. Al-Halaj was saying that God is found within each of us and that connecting with the divine takes effort, but is possible by contemplation and worship. Especially, you can reach God within your heart, but only if you have pure intent and a good understanding of the Quran and Sunnah, and above all, the true purpose of Islam, which is set us free. It's not something that can be readily explained. Even learned scholars who spend their life studying Islam know that matters are complex. Those who give quick, easy answers are those who do not know. People were killed over the centuries because of the knowledge of this, because leaders in the powerful world would not want ordinary people to know that they can think for themselves or find the truth by searching inwardly. Instead, leaders and clerics demand only subservient obedience to their demands. Any teaching that undermines obedience would only stand to weaken the power and influence of the mighty, which is why this truth was suppressed and hidden for so long. And so these peers have this special knowledge that they have, the 100th name, and they pass that secret on. But if you go to a place like Bangladesh, 1 minute, and these peers, when they get buried, their graves are special. They build madrasas beside those graves, and those people are his followers. And so they'll have what they call mahfils, religious meetings. I was at one that had 200,000 people there. I won't go again. It scared me too bad. But one of the first things they'd want to do is show me the Hujars or the pier's grave. That's why we had gathered there, because of the power of the man who was buried there, because of a special knowledge that he had that gives access to what's beyond. Because, face it, we want to connect. We desire to connect. And when that connection is not offered, people will turn to where there is power. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. All recordings from Reach 2022 are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. To purchase additional recordings from Reach or other Faith Builders events, visit us online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769.